This is the No Stroke Podcast with your co-hosts, David Dansereau and Michael Garrow, helping you to support and thrive in life after stroke. Their podcast is designed for educational and community support purposes only and should not replace medical treatment and guidance of your own health professional team.
Welcome, everyone, to episode 35 of the No Stroke Podcast. My name is David Dansereau, and I'm here with my co-host, Michael Garrow. Hi, Mike.
How are we doing, David?
Doing well.
I like the swag tonight, David. We're recording it later in the evening. We've officially hit sweater season, which means you're able to pull out the No Stroke Podcast.
Yeah. It was time.
Love it.
I had to get the wrinkles out, and but I'm nice and toasty here. So for those watching, maybe on YouTube, you could, if you're excited about the swag, maybe you want to get us to pre-order or get these on our website somehow, Mike.
I think the holiday season means a re-up of a No Stroke swag. Let's do it. Beanies, sweaters, whatever you'd like. We can make it happen.
Let's try it.
All right. So we recorded this episode last week. But anything pop up in the news this week happening right now? Anything happen?
Yeah, actually, a real interesting article out of Neuro Rehab Times. I hadn't heard of that publication before, but their spotlight story, they're out of the UK, and their spotlight story was on Amelia Clark, who is a brain injury survivor from multiple brain injuries many years ago. But the title is Breaking Down Boundaries After Brain Injury. Her and her mom founded Same You, which we've talked a bit about before and in a recent episode with Dr. Nick Ward over there that we also talked about some intercollaboration they have. But the article is really dives into, uses her personal experience and to really challenge the stigma around brain injury and their advocacy around widening access to neuro rehab. So it's a really well done article with, part of their research. We talked a little bit about building out a platform for stroke and survivorship. They're doing something very similar, and certainly ours was on a much smaller scale. But what they're really, what they did in their research was fascinating to me. In the article, was really dove into thousands of brain injury survivor stories, and just how access to care just drops off a cliff after that 6 weeks. And they're
yeah. I mean, we've talked to how many? Yeah, we've talked to how many survivors, and it's that case across the globe. When we were working with the Irish population, it's the same, no matter where you are, it's that, barrier to access, which, it takes folks like Amelia. So if you're not familiar with Amelia Clark, she's an actress, best known for her role on Game of Thrones. And, she's really taken this opportunity to advocate and build a community and really drive some change. So yeah, it's been fascinating to see what they've done. We'd love to maybe have a conversation with, is it Jenny? Is that her mom?
Her mom is Jenny. Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think she runs a lot of the advocacy and the foundation. So yeah, it'd be great to bring them on and kind of talk through, what they've been able to develop and some of what they're thinking.
For sure. Yeah, how about on your end, Mike? Sparked your interest?
Yeah, I think, going back to a previous guest, Brooke Bedell, that we had on, at this stage, maybe a year ago, I think we had her on before their last strokes symposium. So she's from UConn Health here in the States. Hartford, Connecticut is where they're based out of, but they're putting on what's now their fourth annual stroke symposium. Have a great lineup of speakers, some survivors, and really be able to cater this for a hybrid event, which is cool. So they'll have a Zoom access link for folks to, if you're across the pond or if you're not local to Connecticut, You could access the event on October 27th from 5 to 7 p.m. We'll share a link in the show notes and push it out on social as well if you're interested.
Yeah, we got a couple of weeks to help them promote that event. I think it was successful for them in the past and glad to support their efforts. They're doing great work.
Yeah. Let's jump into it. So this week we have Dr. Sadiq from Hyperfine. So Hyperfine is a company that we spoke about kind of in the news portion of our podcast. Probably, I think the first time we noticed it was when they announced their partnership with Viz AI. That was about 2 months ago, I think. So we've been working with folks at Hyperfine to make this happen. And we're, delighted to have been able to speak with Dr. Sadiq. So Dr. Sadiq is a serial entrepreneur, radiologist, and currently the chief medical officer and chief strategy officer at Hyperfine. Hyperfine have created the world's first FDA-approved portable MRI scanner. Say that again, portable MRI scanner. It's kind of, it's almost science fiction, right? You think of these big, massive machines down in the basement of a hospital, and they're bringing that to the bedside. So it was a fascinating discussion to be able to really dive in and learn about the technology and the path forward for Hyperfine. And Dr. Sadiq, just in general, he has a fascinating background. So prior to Hyperfine, he actually founded a company called Higi, and it's a consumer health technology company that was acquired by Babylon Health, which is a huge digital health player over in the UK, on a multi-billion dollar SPAC transaction. And those stations from Higi are now located across the globe. I think he said that something close to 12,000 locations have this device, which is pretty much a health screen. If you walk into a retail clinic, take your blood pressure, do a screening. So really fascinating background. Prior to finding Higi, he actually was a physician executive for Microsoft and was responsible for a platform for engineering and AI, which is like one of Microsoft's first steps into AI and machine learning. He has a wealth of knowledge in this area, really took time, had a personal story that really connected, him to Hyperfine and the mission that they're on, and I think, for us, it was a different conversation because we always focus on the post-rehab, but ultimately door to needle time and what happens at that assessment stage and what Hyperfine are able to do to shorten that window to get treatment for stroke survivor. It's really revolutionary. So super excited to dive into this one. As always, if you guys do enjoy this, please subscribe, like, share this with other folks in your network. It does help. So we'll dive into this one. I think we have a full slate of episodes lined up here for October. So excited to get these shared with you guys. And as always, thank you for listening.
We gotta keep moving in October to stay warm. We got a full lineup going into the month. So that's enjoy it. This episode.
Sweat. No stroke swag coming soon. Hi, Khan. Welcome to the No Stroke Podcast. So nice to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. We're really excited to cover, the work that Hyperfine is doing in more of this acute phase for stroke, right? As we mentioned before we started recording here, a lot of our episodes have solely focused on, rehab, life after stroke. But what we're hoping to cover here today is really an important phase of that door to needle time, which ultimately impacts stroke recovery and outcomes, and what you guys are building at Hyperfine, which I'll let you give the spiel on, but it's a pretty cool technology, which is bringing an MRI machine to the bedside. So before we dive deep into that, just for the audience, can you give a bit of background on your career to date and what led you to Hyperfine?
Sure, absolutely. Again, thank you for inviting me. I've listened to a bunch of the podcasts. I'm a big fan. So it's great to be here. I'm a radiologist. I'm currently the chief medical officer and chief strategy officer at Hyperfine. I started my career, as a clinical radiologist trained at NYU and then at Geisinger Health System. My passion in the early days of the career was in cardiac MR initially, mostly. So focused on pediatric cardiac MR. And then I got interested into computer vision, machine learning, and informatics, and ended up moving to University of Maryland to start the U.S.'s first imaging informatics training program. I've trained most of the leaders in informatics and did some of the early work in AI and computer vision, machine learning in University of Maryland, and was a director of MRI at the time. I then moved to Johns Hopkins as associate professor of radiology there and director for Center for Biomedical Imaging Informatics. Same thing, continuing my informatics journey there. And in 2007, got recruited by Microsoft to come lead their healthcare AI team and medical imaging team. So moved to Microsoft to do that. Did some work in machine learning that led to the algorithms for Xbox Connect. So some contribution over there, and then build the early cloud-based architecture for large image storage, which is Microsoft Azure now. So we started some of the early healthcare applications in Azure also. So fascinating time, 5 years at Microsoft, and then left Microsoft to start my next company called Higi. Higi was a company to do hypertension management focused on elderly and low income. So our main population was Medicare Advantage and Medicaid type of patients. And fashion was, everybody was focusing on building technology and wearables for the quantified self crowd. But the problem really was in low income and elderly and patients, people who are making less than $50,000 household income. And what are you doing there? So we came up with this idea of a grocery store and pharmacy-based blood pressure kiosk to use as a hypertension management solution, integration into electronic health record, and eventually build a kind of virtual primary care network across all 50 states on top of that. And we exited it to Babylon Healthcare as part of their $4.2 billion SPAC transaction. So after that exit, I was doing investing different places and on the board on different companies, and got a call from Dr. Jonathan Wattsberg, who founded Hyperfine. Came on initially as a consultant in 2019 and then joined full time in 6 weeks before the pandemic started. So rest is history. So here we are.
That's Dr. Siddiq, so interesting. And you've been just a little bit busy. Can you tell us, we have a sort of a thank you for listening to our show too at the beginning. I heard you mention you're a fan, so that's great to hear. How did you, we have a mix in our audience. Some are clinically oriented, some are entrepreneurs like yourself, physicians. And some of our audience are also guests, are also caregivers and survivors themselves. Before we dive into Hyperfine a little deeper, can you tell our audience a little bit more about sort of the beginnings of like the MRI machine? Because a lot of folks that come in, they think of, they had their brain image, they think of, like a CAT scan, or they think of other imaging technologies. Can you talk a little bit about that without getting too deep into it?
Sure, absolutely. So MR technology evolved over the years. The first MR scanners started to come out in the 70s, late 70s. And the early scanners were all made out of permanent magnets and low field strength, similar to what we have. And then in 1986, Picker International, which then ended up becoming GE Healthcare, commissioned the first 1.5 Tesla MR scanner. So the MRs, our scanner, are measured based on the field strength of the magnet, and which is measured in Teslas. So most common MR scanner you will see in a hospital is a 1.5 Tesla scanner. And what MR scanners doing is really, a majority of them are imaging hydrogen atoms or protons. and they look at density of protons or intensity generated by the proton and how it reacts. So proton in water molecules, proton in carbohydrates, proteins, fats, they all react. They all have different properties under a magnetic field. And those differences are what we ended up taking advantage of to generate the image and be able to see those tissues differently. So it's really a proton imager if you think of it that way. If I want to give an analogy how it works, it's a combination of a microwave oven and an electric generator, right? So think of electric generator. How does it work? You move a magnet inside a coiled electromagnet, and that moving a magnet inside another magnet generates electric current that is measured, that's taken by the coils and powers up your light. So what the microwave oven does is puts radio frequency pulse to vibrate the water molecules in the food, and that's how they heat up. So what we do is in MR, we throw that RF radio frequency pulse that vibrates the hydrogen atoms and water molecules in your human body, which are tiny magnets, right? Proton is a tiny magnet. And as it moves, because of that after vibrate recovering back to align with the main magnetic field, then movement generates electric current in the receive coils that we then detect. And that movement is different based on which molecule the hydrogen atom is attached to. And that's how we would see difference. So hopefully that was a very layman understanding of how MR works. So that's kind of the origin story. And the once, you know, in the early days were low field strength, and when Picker started the 1.5 Tesla MR scanner, then the arm race to making the bigger and bigger magnet started. So it akin to went towards the, you know, how mainframes got developed, you know, taking up large rooms, requiring special people to use it. And then here comes Hyperfine disrupting that, like a laptop disrupted mainframe computers, right? How do we actually make it such that it's simple to use, anybody can use it, and moves where the patient is, you know, being patient, thinking of patient the patient first and others later, and really making it convenient for the patient. So that was kind of the evolution of MR, how it's happened. The other thing that's happened in MR is that specialty MRs have developed. So we think MR is just as one modality, but there are multiple, right? There are MR scanners of different field strength that are used for different applications. There are MR scanners dedicated for just knee imaging, for example. There are MR scanners dedicated for baby imaging, neonatal scanners. There are MR scanners designed for use in the operating room. The gigantic machines hang from the ceiling you bring into the room. So there are a plethora of, there are like at least what I would say about 10 different types of devices that are used, and they just become a tool, all the arsenal in clinicians' pocket to use to address different needs in routine care scenarios. And then ours is a brand new category of portable point of care MR that you bring into the patient's bedside.
It's fascinating. So you're changing the game, right? Like you really are, you know, that you said it was an arms race to build the bigger imagery, and now you're bringing convenience to that, right? And okay. And what does, you know, there's all these different types of MR strengths, right? And different types of screening. What's the most common used for scanning for stroke?
It's the 1.5 Tesla scanners okay. are the most common. These are the big machines that you see in the basement right. of hospitals. That's the most common. 3 Tesla is probably the second most common scanner field strength that is out there.
Mm-hmm. So when you joined Hyperfine, was this mission already like, was it a genius banks, you know, of Dr. Rothenberg? Like, did he have the concept idea, and like what really, you know, brought you to the space you are right now to ultimately be, you know, rolling this out commercially?
Yeah, I'll tell you my reason, my why. Like, why do I do things I do, right? I try to solve problems that somebody I love is affected by it and create a social impact at the same time. So that's kind of my inner why. And Jonathan started this idea for exactly same reason, right? So he had personal things in which he was getting a lot of MRs on a frequent basis. And he asked that question, why do I have to go to the MR? Why can't the MR come to me? and put together a group of scientists, advisors, and engineers, and gave them a challenge. Can you do imaging in a portable manner? And the first reaction everybody has is that physics doesn't work like that. And then the question is why? And then when they start going through those whys, and you're like, well, why not? And then suddenly realize like, oh yeah, these are all artificial boundaries and you can actually think about it. So he literally has the same reason why I joined Hyperfine. It was somebody in, you know, he himself and somebody that he loves had a problem, and he asked the question, why, how can we bring the MR? Mine was, and we, you know, my mom, who is my role model, one day woke up and wasn't speaking and had a weakness in her left arm and left leg. And, you know, she's in Pakistan and get a call from my sister, you know, that, hey, what do I do? And it's 2 a.m. and we live in a city that is size of Philadelphia with 0 MR scanners, right? I mean, population size of Philadelphia with no MR scanners, right? So now my sister has to drive my mom 2.5 hours to Karachi, the bigger city where the MR is. And I'm making sure she's getting scanned on time, people are ready, and waiting for those 3 hours to get the images and making sure there's no stroke. Fortunately, she didn't have any stroke. Actually, she recovered from the same symptom by the time they arrived to the imaging center. But in my mind, that happened, and I'm started to think, how do I solve this problem, right? How do I... And my initial reaction was like, can I get some donations to put a scanner in the city down there? And then 6 months after that event is when I got a call from Jonathan with this crazy idea of, have we make a portable MR scanner? And mine was like, yeah, that needs to be in my home. Yes. And so that's what got me into it. When I came on board, the team was already on the path to submit to FDA for the clearance. You know, help optimize what the go-to-market strategy needs to be, build the leadership team, did the funding round that needed to happen, and then help take the company public as part of the process, and refine the strategy on what the product should be doing, what should we focus on, what use cases are, and really, really ingraining the team that, you know, our value, number one value, is patient first. It's unfortunate a lot of even hospitals don't think that way, right? And technology companies don't think that way. Like, when you think the patient is the first person you're serving, they are the top of the pyramid, then it's the physician and the staff taking care of the patient, then is the hospital administration taking, you know, then is the shareholders, then you have your priority aligned the right way, and you solve the right problems, and you go in the right direction. And that was the reason for being here, and really aligning with how Jonathan thought of where the company should be. And that worked and clicked in my head also.
I love hearing that backstory and the mission aligning and the timing. I'm always feel that something happens for a reason, and that timing, as you described, you know, that's, you know, Mike and I are on a similar journey in terms of our mission here with our podcast. And so you said something really interesting in describing the product line. You said you took an IBM, essentially not using term, but a mainframe, and you brought it in to the size of a laptop. Can you talk about that, the technology a little bit, and how that can come to happen? And also, you must have a lot of happy fans in part of the clinical team. And I'm married to an RN, so I totally understand the heavy lift it is, and sometimes a heavy lift to get a patient down into that basement you describe, and the resources it takes. So can you talk a little bit about the technology that powers this? Because we talked a little bit about the Tesla and the strength. I'd love to hear more about the technology.
Sure. So if you think of it this way, right? So why did Tesla make the successful electric car, and why couldn't Toyota, GM, Ford do it? Because there's something ingrained in the incumbent's brain that it's hard for them to get out of. In car scenario, it was the combustion engine. Right? So they were building hybrid cars, but they couldn't get out of that mindset, like, how would we go full electric, right? in MR, there's the same fundamental belief that you need homogeneous magnetic field to perfectly homogeneous field to create beautiful images. The reason is when MR started, we just didn't have the compute power, right, in the 70s and 80s. So these principles of having homogeneous magnetic field started in those days where you couldn't correct for inhomogeneity or distortion of the field in software because it required a lot of compute power. So that was number one, right? Once we realize it scanner needs to move around, then we realize, we ask the question, how will we create a homogeneous field when you could be parked right next to a gigantic pillar in a hospital with rebar steel inside it? It's going to distort the field. You could be parked next to a gigantic oxygen tank, that's going to start the field. So we had to throw out that concept, like, well, we will never have a homogeneous field, we'll have to correct it in software. So that was number one, that kind of, okay, fine, now we can actually move it around. Next question was, well, how big can we get it? And we realized that it has to go through a patient's standard hospital door. So then that limited the size, the width of the device, right? So then it's like, okay, fine, how do we do this now? Like, it has to be under 33 inches so that it can go through a typical hospital door very easily. And then obviously, you know, how do you reduce projectile risk so people things are not flying around? That limited to the field strength. So we had to go down to 64 millitesla or 0.06 tesla scanner. And when you, so that was the next thing. The third thing was that we, typical MR scanner requires a lot of power, right? This almost takes as much power as a nuclear submarine, right? It has, you know, electromagnets, requires cooling, requires gases, you know, that are cooling it almost to absolute zero. And that requires a lot of power. And we wanted to be able to plug into any wall outlet, which meant we had to use permanent magnets. We couldn't use electromagnets. We had to use permanent magnets. So that reinforced that idea. And the last thing was the noise in the environment. Typical MR room is shielded in a Faraday cage. So it's a copper cage that they put the magnet in so that, you know, in noise from your cell phones, the radio frequency noise and electromagnetic noise from light fixtures, from monitors, is not interfering with the signal coming from the tissues that you're imaging. And we had to figure out how to solve that without a shield. So we came up with noise canceling technology, just like noise canceling headphones do, to cancel out the environmental electromagnetic and RF noise in this. So it was figuring out how to correct images and not rely on homogeneous magnetic field. It was figuring out noise cancellation for environmental noise. It was figuring out how to run the magnet in a normal electric outlet. So now we only require power as a coffee maker does. If you can plug a coffee maker in, you can plug our scanner in. Right? It is max 600 watts of power needed, max, right? So you can run it on a, a regulatory cleared, but you can run it on a battery pack if you wanted to do it. We don't advertise to commercialize that way, but technically you could do it. So
wow, yeah. I mean, that the innovation technology, like that had to be brought to be able to deliver something like that. I mean, it's nuanced, and for, you know, when you're now describing this to doctors, you know, in the hospital, what's their first reaction? Are they like, how is this possible? And maybe, you know, in light of that, you know, we could maybe cover some of the recent clinical trials that you guys are diving into to prove this efficacy.
I think that's exactly the first reaction, right? That's like, what? Like, that even possible or not? One thing I didn't mention was that because we're using such a low field strength, the signal is very low. And we use AI machine learning and to really recreate the image and using that to generate diagnostic quality images. So that was one of the fourth innovation that we did. I think the it's very interesting, right? It really depends on who we're talking to and what is the pain point they feel. So our primary call point has been neurocritical care and neuro ICU and post-stroke patient care in the hospital. And as you mentioned, you know, your wife being nurse, David, that's where we get immediate reactions, right? We literally, when we do demos, we go in the hospital, it's the nurses that clap and give us, you know, standing ovation when we are leaving from the thing, because they feel the most pain when you have to transfer an ICU patient who's on multiple IV lines, multiple drips, none of them MR compatible, on a ventilator, on a cardiac monitor, on a non-compatible bed. You have to now convert all of that stuff into MR compatible equipment, then go down with the patient, sign off all your other patients that you were managing to somebody else to go deal with, respiratory therapist, everybody goes down. It's like a, you know, giant expedition that that happens every time.
Yeah, and just not to interrupt, but then you hope that nothing goes bad on the way down, right?
Exactly, right? And 20 to 40% of these transport patients who are transported have some adverse event that create more complication and other things. So that's where, you know, you start with the value, right? So they see the immediate value. The clinicians taking care of patient in the neuro ICU see the value immediately because they order an MR scanner in the morning and it may be 25, 26 hours before they get the results because of all the logistics to go figure out how to go image the patient. And the hospital administration, right? I mean, with the new value-based care and DRG-based billing, if you're keeping the patient longer in the ICU, it's actually costing the hospital more, right? So they're incentivized to move these patients out of the ICUs and step-down units and discharge them out and make those right decisions for the patient. Even for the patient also, right? Reduce their cost of care by making decisions quickly. And as you guys said, right? Time is brain, right? The faster you can make those decisions, the faster you have better outcomes you have. So it's a win-win for everybody. It's win for the clinicians, win for the nursing staff, win for the patient, and win for the hospital administration. One of the things I always used to say is that, you know, when you come in with a breakthrough technology, somebody always doesn't win, right? So when robotic surgery came out, you know, nurses hated it, right? Because it was complex to set it up. It cost more to the hospital than not doing it. So there were a lot of headwinds against it, but here they're not, right? It's benefiting everybody who's actually using it.
I know, Mike, you wanted to ask about the clinical trials. I just had one question. So you eliminate the transport time and all the other risks that go along with that. All the MRI pre-screening precautions are still taken. It's just you're bringing that machine to your technology to the bedside. How long does a scan take from? Is the time as the actual imaging sequence? Is it about the same time, or what does that look like, and how does that play out?
It's slightly longer than we are 23 times less magnetic field strength. So you have to scan longer to be able to get the signal coming in. So we probably a couple of minutes more per sequence. So end up being maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes, depending on what the exam protocol is, longer than what you would do at 1.5. So number one is our screening protocol is simpler, right? A lot of the risk of EKG leads and things flying around don't exist, right? So you have a simplified protocol. You don't have to worry about some of the passive metal, right, that typically you would worry about in a conventional MR scanner. You don't have to worry about that. So the simplified screening process, number one. Number two is you're reducing all the transport-related time. A scanner can sit in the ICU, is literally drive from that closet into the patient's room right here, and then you're imaging. So maybe it's 10 minutes longer, but guess what? You saved hours of time overall. The one thing I forgot to mention was that how does it benefit radiology, right? So a typical ICU patient takes 3 slots in an MR scanner because of the complexity of setting the patient up, getting it in there, and all the stuff. They could do 3 outpatients in the same time they would do 1 inpatient, right? That's how they benefit also, you know, both from a patient throughput point of view as well as financially, but you know, throughput is more important in my mind to get more and more patients done. So absolutely, right? Even though the actual scan time is probably 10 minutes longer, the overall time savings is in hours.
And to jump back, you mentioned the use of machine learning to improve the image quality, right? You've also announced a recent partnership with Viz AI, who've used a machine learning and artificial intelligence to more so aid in the clinical decision support of the imaging process, right? Can you speak to that partnership and how the two technologies are coming together?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what Viz AI is, and a lot of the companies that are coming out in the future are thinking about the care continuum, not just one point in time, but actually here's the patient and what is the journey through this care pathway for stroke in this case, right? And today their care continuum stops when you identify a stroke. And they always thought of like, okay, fine, we want to be involved in, after we've done treatment, then what's the value of this AI to the process and how do you assess the patient? Well, that's where we fit in, right? We are that post-treatment follow-up imaging modality that is observing that stroke long-term, seeing if any complications happening, strokes improving or not. And that was a perfect partnership, right? They are in the initial early detection portion of it, identifying the patient who can go for thrombectomy via stroke, and then patient gets admitted in the ICU and then hyperfine starts. So as you think about from this AI point of view, they wanted to continue to bleed into the care continuum of this patient throughout the journey in the hospital. And we wanted to be part of that journey of care. And that the care is happening using a tool in this scenario with AI. It made sense to partner with them and provide those patients and clinicians one way to actually manage their patient through the entire journey in the hospital. So our first implementation with Viz AI, the partnership that we're starting, we are starting with just notification aspect of it, right? So today, when the scan is complete, the idea is the scan immediately available, notification goes to the clinician and the entire care team, hey, MR is done, and here, look at it, right? So they can easily look at it.
Cool. So yeah, I mean, they've definitely, when you think like, AI and they've certainly made a presence in the space. So I'm happy to see this collaboration happen. I think it's going to be, beneficial for both sides. And obviously, like you pointed to earlier, the patient, right? Ultimately, that's who's, the beneficiary. So yeah, I'd love to, just as we start to wrap up here, you've announced a couple of recent clinical trials, in hospital systems across the country. Can you speak to some of those outcomes? And then, what's your plan to really scale this and get this as a unit across the country and into hospitals in Pakistan?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've done multiple things, right? As part of Jonathan's mission to democratize healthcare and our mission to be everywhere, we partnered with Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation earlier on, in which they've deployed about 25 scanners, 2020 scanners already into limited resource settings. And then they just signed up for I think total of 45 scanners that are going to be deployed in limited resource settings. So in sub-Saharan Africa, in India and Pakistan and other places where they're really thinking about, how do you actually provide access to imaging around that, right? So you'll see a lot of publications coming out. Some have already come out, more coming out, in which we are pushing the boundary on both what can we do from an imaging point of view and can detect with our device, and also utility of the device and standard operating procedures in those settings. In the US, our focus has been mostly in the ICU scenario to date. So a lot of the publications that have come out are validating and making sure our imaging performs at par to CT and MR, what is out there today. So a lot of work at Yale with Dr. Kevin Sheth and at MGH and Dr. Taylor Kimberly has been really to show equivalence of our imaging modality with standard of care, both for stroke detection, ischemic strokes, hemorrhagic strokes, extra-axial collections, and just management of the ICU patient. In the ICU, there have been a lot of work from our UPenn folks on multiple sclerosis. I'm really excited about the work that our researchers at Johns Hopkins are doing on ECMO. So ECMO is extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or a heart-lung machine. When the patient is put on heart-lung machine, 33% of them get some kind of neurological symptoms abnormalities. But those patients today cannot be imaged on any modality. They can't get a CT scan or an MR. Because, you know, in CT scan, the contrast inject in the vein, well, the heart is sitting outside, the machine's pumping the blood, not circulation, so it doesn't work. And that machines are not compatible with traditional MR, whereas in our scenario, the study is showing they are. We are planning to start a big study on stroke and really documenting and figuring out in the stroke pathway where we fit in. So it's in partnership with MGH, Ohio State University, and SUNY Buffalo. We'll be starting in Q4, maybe early next year, really looking at what's the value of hyperfine soup in the stroke pathway. And those three sites have different protocols. And it's a multi-center study across three institutions looking at utility of portable MR in management of stroke patient. And again, the aims really are, can we reduce, you know, time to needle type scenarios? Can we identify risk? Can we expand the number of patients who can be treated? As you guys all know, right, only 20% of patients are treated who present with stroke today, right? So how do you expand that treatment window for thrombectomy as well as for IVTPA? That's the goal.
Going to be real busy, and this is exciting. And I apologize there; I could not unmute myself. I just have to ask too, because you mentioned, you know, the 20% and the treatment. And I know, Mike, we're running up on time, so we'll hand you off to the magic question. One question on deployment. The last stroke conference we went to, there was a lot of talk about these. I think the term was used: MSUs, mobile stroke units. Is this something that you guys are thinking of too? Can they go in a vehicle and get out in the community?
I think people are pushing us in that direction. There have been some people that have put scanner in the ambulance and actually done some scanning. I think we need to still do some work, really understand the utility of it and how will we actually make it work if we go in that direction. Remember, in the CT is easy, right? You're just imaging, looking for density. In MR, it's diffusion weighted imaging. And what are we detecting? We're actually detecting motion of water across the cell membrane. Now talk about, you're detecting very micro motion in a moving object.
Good point.
We have enough heart problems to solve because now you're adding motion on top of it. Becomes very challenging, right?
So, you wouldn't. Yeah, you wouldn't want my girlfriend driving to get that. I'll tell you that.
There are some interesting things happening, right? Dr. Donna Roberts at Medical School of South Carolina is looking at use of the device in imaging astronauts, right? So when astronauts go for long space flights, they develop neuroocular syndromes when they come back, and we don't understand the etiology behind it. And because we've not been able to image astronauts in zero gravity. So she has an amazing, you know, proposal out there to try to image the brain in zero gravity. So I think the work that happens over there, where we have to now image while on a spaceship, will solve the stroke problem also.
One day to space. Well, now this, it kind of tees up our magic wand question. As we end every show, you know, we'd like to kind of get your perspective on future stroke and really to put it in your hands. And I think you've had a long career in this field, you know, through, you know, the clinical lens, but also a very, you know, unique lens within, you know, technology, machine learning, and the power that that might have. So if you could be handed a magic wand and redesign the stroke care pathway, what would that look like for a patient?
I think for me, it's a magic pill that you take as soon as you start developing symptoms, and it corrects that right there, right? So all this stuff becomes irrelevant then, right? You're just treating it yourself. If you want me to do magic wand, that's what I would get there.
The junk, right? Well, then detection, right? Because detection is the biggest thing, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you can detect and take something at home that preserves the brain, is the ultimate thing. And people are doing work in it, right? So some of the research that I know are looking at therapeutics that can be implemented even by the EMT before the patient even arrives to the hospital, that are safe enough that even if you don't have it, it's fine. But actually, it, as you know, you guys know, right, how many million neurons per minute are compromised, the more delay it is. So what if you could do something right away yourself that stops any more brain death happening, and then you can get evaluated and see what is happening, and if you require, you know, if you have an occlusion that can be improved and things that can happen future on. So that's my magic one, would be magic pill that can stop for the damage of the brain right at home as soon as you start getting symptoms.
That's truly the best outcome.
Yeah. We haven't heard it. I think that's a great opportunity for Babylon to explore with Higgy as a, you know, in-home device, stroke detection, right? A little pill dispensary. Yeah. But we do really appreciate you taking the time here to chat with us this evening. I think, you know, again, really having a strong understanding of the work that you're doing to be able to, again, like we've kept iterating here, you know, save that door to needle time, ultimately impacts that life after stroke and really where we focus our attention. But I think it was a really unique, you know, episode to be able to put a lens on this for folks. So thank you for, you know, sharing your time, your expertise, and, you know, the magic wand was the first of its kind. We haven't heard that one yet. So.
Yeah. And really thank you for sharing your why. Yeah, that's resonated with us, and I know will that resonate with our listeners. So we're going to put all the resources for your company in the show notes, and I'll encourage listeners who want to get a visual on this technology to go to the website. There's also some great YouTube videos that show your technology being presented at radiology conferences, and, you know, really cutting edge stuff, and really excited to follow how you know, all the great work you're doing. So thanks again.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being here. Loved the interaction.
Great. Thanks, Kyle.